massive series of studies was done where they found that for decades we've been living longer, obviously because of advances in medicine and technology, but that reversed, started reversing in 96. By 2014, it was an established reversal. It's called deaths of categorized as deaths of despair. So essentially, people are dying 8 to 25 years younger than they should. Now, in this modern age, it's 2 years added to this with the pandemic, from preventable lifestyle issues. So people are dying younger. And Gen Z is the most medicated generation ever in history. And they are the most risk of dying 8 to 25 years younger, which is terrible. And it's our fault as adults, as leaders, as whatever, because our generation has adopted the last 40 years has totally messed us up.
Welcome to the Michaela Peterson Podcast, episode 113 with Dr. Caroline Leaf. This was one of my favorite podcasts on brain plasticity. Caroline is brilliant. I managed to get off of psych meds myself and heal with diet, but part of what I did was change my response to stimuli. That happened somewhat naturally due to dietary change, but Dr. Leaf, a communication pathologist and cognitive neuroscientist, actually explained what happened to me when I healed from major depressive disorder. She helps people understand their minds and change their lives for the better. Dr. Leaf is the best-selling author of Switch On Your Brain, Think, Learn, Succeed, Think and Eat Yourself Smart, and her most recent, Cleaning Up Your Mental Mess, 5 Simple Scientifically Proven Steps to Reduce Anxiety, Stress, and Toxic Thinking. This stuff works. She has papers and brain scans showing how to reduce anxiety and toxic brain pathways and grow new ways of thinking. Cutting edge, crazy interesting stuff. Enjoy this episode. If you like it, remember to hit subscribe. Dr. Caroline Leaf, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you. It's so good to be with you, Michaela.
I'm really looking forward to this. I've been following your work for a while. I've been very interested in trauma and how to get rid of it and what the state of your mind can do to your overall health. And you cover that a lot in your recent book.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I guess, well, we should just start with... For anyone who doesn't know you, can you give a bit of a brief background about who you are and what it is you do?
Absolutely. Well, I'm a cognitive and clinical neuroscientist and communication pathologist, and that's a big mouthful for someone who works with the mind-brain-body connection. So I've been trained in a very interesting way. I've done all the psychology and I've done medicine, and sort of a mixture of psychology, medicine, neuropsychology, neuroscience, communication. It was a specialized degree that they did for a period of time, and I tell you this to say that my training was very unique, and when I was doing it, I thought, gosh, why am I doing this? Because it was so hard. But I'm so glad because it forced me to understand an area that is one of the most badly researched areas, in my opinion, in the world of science. And we see the impact today in the current medical, the psychiatric movement, which you and I were briefly discussing in the just before we started. So basically what I do is I look at people's, how they're functioning, how they're showing up, what are they saying, what are they doing, what are the behaviors, what are the emotions, what are their mindsets, what's happening there, because that's not who they are. That's evidence that there's something going on in their life. And that's that principle then, it teaches you to be what I'd call a thought detective, where you can actually say, okay, these are my patterns and why am I doing this? And because that's not actually how I'm wired, because we literally are wired, our psychoneurobiology is wired for love, literally for survival. And then to track back and find out the thoughts behind that and then the thinking process that built the thought in the first place, right down to the root or the origin. So if someone's showing up with major emotional things like depression and can't form a relationship and whatever, you track that back from that pattern all the way back down to the root, which could be traumatic child abuse or some kind of trauma in childhood or early adulthood or whatever. So everything has a root. And what we see from brain science is that you can't just slap a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. You can't just suppress something or do a few techniques or a bit of meditation or a bit of breathing, which are all important, but all they do is prepare the brain. They don't rewire the brain and they don't change the brain. So I wanted to understand the principle of rewiring the brain, which is neuroplasticity, and how long it takes and what do you do and what is doing the rewiring. And that's the mind. So I did a lot of work on the mind-brain separation. What are the differences between the mind and the brain? And how can we control the brain and how can we direct the neuroplasticity in the brain? So that's kind of a summary. And I started off in the world, very therapeutic world of working with traumatic brain injury and Alzheimer's and traumas and, you know, hectic traumas, war trauma, sexual trauma, learning disabilities, autism, that sort of thing. And then very soon saw that I needed to develop systems that would help people to, you know, manage their minds to change their brain, because people were just kind of doing therapy and getting stuck, you know, not really moving forward. And I wanted to change that. And then that's why I developed theories and systems. And I've continued over these years to do clinical research and make this available to everyone, because we all have a mind, we all have a brain, and we all need to manage it daily. So that's kind of a big picture overview of what I did. I don't practice anymore. I've practiced for 25 years as a clinical neuroscientist. Now what I do is I continue my research, and everything I do and have learned, I put into books and materials, and I have an app and that kind of thing to try and help people manage their mind.
Okay, so let me see, where do I want to start? That was a lot of information.
It was.
That was good though. I think, well, might as well start where I want to, which is, how long does it take to change your brain?
That's an excellent question. So if I may preface that with just the mind-brain separation, and then we can talk in terms of the time, because I think that's quite important. We live in a day and an age where the mind and the brain are used interchangeably. So I've got a couple of props. So for those that are listening, I'm holding up a model brain in a skull. And we've advanced dramatically since the mid-90s to now about understanding the neuroscience of the brain, which is amazing. But on the negative side, it's made the philosophy of mind very neurocentric. So people are all about brain, brain, brain. So it's my brain, make me do it. My brain's broken. My brain's diseased. I'm depressed because I've got a brain disease.
Yeah.
You familiar with that language? Okay.
So, yes.
And it's very unfortunate, because 38 years ago, when I started in this field, mind and brain were seen as separate but interchangeable. So mind drove brain. Brain was physical. Mind is this force that drives the brain. It's your ability to think, feel, and choose. And when you're dead, you don't think, feel, and choose. And so your brain doesn't do anything. But they didn't believe the brain could change in the early 80s. So I did some of the first.
That's interesting.
Super interesting. So they understood mind, brain, but they didn't believe the brain could change. So I challenged that and did some of the first neuroplasticity research in the early 90s, showing that people with traumatic brain injuries can, if they use their mind, which they can then change their brain. And I showed that. I showed the 35 to 75% improvements in cognitive, emotional, social function, changes in the brain, everything. And that kind of launched me into my career that I've been in for the last.
From traumatic brain injuries.
From that, and learning disabilities and emotional traumas and Alzheimer's, dementias.
Alzheimer's and dementia.
I worked with those as well, and autism and all those things. So essentially mind is what we're using now to be able to talk to each other. It's your ability to listen to me, process what I'm saying, think, feel, and choose. You're pushing that in your brain, and you're converting what I'm saying into little trees in your brain that literally look like this. You're building thought trees in your brain, and that enables you to then process what I'm saying, apply, and then talk about it. That's what we're doing all day long. So mind is the force. It's the first cause. If you're dead, if you and I were dead, we couldn't have this conversation. We wouldn't see any changes in the brain. Mm. But because we are talking now, if I linked you and I up to various different types of brain technology that I use in my research, we would see massive activity in your brain. We'd see growth and change and so on. So mind is the force that creates the change. Mind is the force that drives the neuroplasticity. And mind is you and me, your ability to think, feel, and choose, your ability to be human, to experience life, to process life. That's the psychological. And then on a physics level, it's gravitational fields and electromagnetic forces. And so if I put a QEEG on your brain right now, we would see a lot of energy response. But if I put it on a dead brain, we would see no energy response. So the mind is taking what we're saying. It's all the psychology stuff of understanding what we're saying, think, feel, choose. But there's also this force that gets pushed through the brain. The mind gets pushed through the brain responds electromagnetically and chemically and builds thoughts. So that's the basic fundamental process. That's neuroplasticity. It's driven by mind. It's happening all the time. Your mind never stops. You can go 3 weeks without food, 3 days without water, 3 minutes without oxygen, but you can't even go 3 seconds without your mind stopping. Your mind never stops. So your mind is awake when you're awake. It's awake when you're asleep. It just never stops. It's what you eat with. It drives your digestive system. It drives your dreams. Every single thing is mind-driven. So essentially our mind is kind of messy because we don't really, we're constantly hypothesizing. We like little scientists. We don't know what's coming up, the events, the circum. So sometimes we, you know, we respond well, sometimes we don't respond well. So it's a whole hit and miss situation. And we, that's okay. Our psycho neurobiology, our mind, brain, body can handle that. What we can't handle is not managing the mess. So when we make a mess, like let's say we get irritated because someone cuts in front of us in traffic or something, that's okay. It's frustrating. And that's okay to be messy and to get irritated and maybe shout, scream, swear, whatever. But you don't want to stay there because the disruption and dysregulation that that creates, and this is a very simple example, and I'll take it to a more complex one in a moment, but that dysregulation creates a pattern in the brain that if you don't stabilize it, it will then become a toxic, something toxic. And mm-hmm. so the protein structures change and you get this downstream effect into your body, you know, the mind-brain-body connection.
Can we Sorry, and I really don't mean to interrupt.
No.
Can you actually get into that a little bit, maybe after, like what happens when you're in, say, like a chronic stress or something?
Okay. I'm going to do that. I'll explain that with some really simple examples.
Okay.
And then we'll, and I'll talk quickly about, should I quickly finish about this and then the 60th
day? Yeah.
And then we'll come back. But that's a really, it's an excellent example and I'm glad we're going to go there. So essentially that dysregulation happens and if we don't manage that mess and it accumulates and you keep getting messy and you just stay messy the whole day and your whole life and, you know, you just keep complaining and angry and frustrated, eventually it just accumulates and you have a lot of toxicity in your brain. And instead of building a healthy thought, which is the green tree I'm holding up, you actually build a toxic thought. So if you don't manage your mess, this toxic thought becomes established. And when it becomes established, it's an actual physical protein structure, much like the COVID virus or any bacteria, which are physical viruses, which are physical things in your brain. And this creates terrible disturbance in the brain and the body. The immune system wants to fight it and all kinds of stuff. So this
How do you know? I'm sorry to interrupt again, but how do you know that it isn't that that's causing the behavior? How do you know that it's
this? It is this. So therefore there's two, okay, so there's two parts here. So excellent question. So here we are in life. We drive in the car, the irritation happens. There's a response. So it wasn't there before. You have the response. You get irritated.
Yes.
And this builds in the brain. If you manage it, it goes away and it's gone and it's done. And you got through. You say, okay, well, I got irritated. It's okay. I'm going to calm down. I'm going to keep driving. Let that person cut in. Whatever you do to just get yourself. And that's a simple example. But let's say now that you, in childhood, you got abused or you're bullied at school or you're in the workplace and you're being bullied or whatever, the millions of things that can go wrong in life, which do. Mm-hmm. Each of those is an experience of you in life. You're processing that experience through your mind into your brain and you're growing these trees. Now, for those of you that are watching or listening, I'm holding up a toxic tree. Any tree has roots. So if you plant a tree, it's got a seed and then there's roots and then there's a tree trunk and then there's branches. That's exactly what happens with a thought. So if you have an established trauma, things that are going wrong or cumulatively going wrong over life, every experience grows like this. It's as the experience starts, that's the seed. Then as this experience is happening, the emotions, the physical, whatever, all the detail of the experience, the email, the toxic words, the toxic people, what's being said, what's being done, all of that is building into the root system. That's the origin. Now that immediately gets processed. There's a tree trunk and it's all distorted and twisted. So because this is distorted incoming information, the interpretation we make is distorted. So we think, feel and choose about that in a distorted way. Then we build these branches, which is above the ground. The branches are then our coping mechanism, the trauma responses, the think, feel, choose, details, emotions, that kind of stuff of what we've experienced. So when that happens, this thing is a whole thought structure. It's protein, it's got energy, it's generating energy. This then produces our behaviors. And this comes full circle back to what I said in the beginning. I train people to be thought detectives to look at, and this answers your question, your patterns and behaviors are here, what you're doing, saying, feeling, etc. And from those haven't come from fresh air, they've come from these. So these produce the behaviors. Okay. So when we look at our patterns, and if there's existing patterns and we get triggered, so if we don't deal with this stuff, it goes back down in our unconscious even stronger than before. You get into a situation, someone says something, boom, it's triggered. Now it's triggered, and now what's happening is added to the roots, added to the system, and then it's reinforced, it gets even stronger, and the behavior that this produces is going to be even more toxic. And then you suppress it, you don't deal with it. And so the thing goes on. Eventually, these are like volcanoes. They explode. And that explodes in your mind, your brain, your body, and in a multitude of different ways. We're all unique. There's no cookie cutter. If this happens, that happens. It's just a whole bunch of stuff that happens. And we've got to kind of deal with that. And you can. I mean, you can rewire that too, because we have volcanoes all the time happening. It's just the nature of life. What I'm trying to teach people to do is understand the process and recognize it's okay to have a volcano. It's not the best thing, but it's okay. You can still repair a volcano. And when the volcano stops firing, eventually the grass that grows over the area of the volcano is healthier than before because of the minerals from the volcano. So you can transform this. So you can't change what's happened to you, but you can change what's in you. And that's the process of neuroplasticity. And your question about how long that takes, how long does it take to find the pattern, find the thought, find the thinking pattern, find the root, deconstruct, reconstruct into a healthy version. That process takes cycles of 63 days. So, and it works in groups of 21. So there's been a lot of misinformation out there that it takes 21 days to form a habit. It doesn't take 21, it takes 63. We have changes happening every 21. The first 21 is generally where we become aware of our patterns and we start becoming a thought detective and we start seeing the data, the emotions and the how you think, feel and choose about yourself, the coping mechanisms, the trauma responses, and you start seeing the roots. So it takes about 21 days to do that kind of deconstruction. But by the end of 21 days, you have built a reconceptualized new thought. It's changed. I'm holding up the green tree and I'm going to pull a little piece of the green tree out. There's a teeny little piece. So this ugly, toxic tree has now been changed, deconstructed, and reconstructed into what you want. It's still part of you. You're still sad. It still happened. But you've changed how it's playing out into your future. So yes, that happened, but that takes about 21 days, a roundabout. Then this is still tiny. And here's where the other two cycles come in. This is where people get stuck. People stop. People get, okay, I've done the work. I know why I'm traumatized. I know why I did this in my life. I know where the depression's coming from or whatever. But then they get stuck here because they haven't stabilized a new pattern of thinking. So that takes another 42 days to change behavior, to have the feeling that I know what to do, but I can't do it, or I'm stuck, or I'm going, you know, I can't do this, and I feel even more guilty, to stop and avoid that and to make this strong. Think of it as a teeny little plant that you have to water and make it nice and strong. That takes another two cycles of 21 days of daily, consistently practicing the new way of thinking. And as you're practicing that in a simple little 5-minute process, you get tremendous insight. So you gain every few days, you gain tremendous insight. And as each time you get insight, you are changing the structure of this little tree. This thought tree is becoming stronger and stronger and stronger, and eventually you'll be in a situation where you're triggered, but this comes up, not the old pattern, and you'll remember, oh, I used to do that, but now I'm doing this. Doesn't mean you're not going to have depression and anxiety, because those aren't illnesses. Those are totally normal human responses. They're warning signals. They're not brain diseases, like we've been told. They're not brain diseases. You can't be depressed. You can't be depression. You can't, as much as you can't be anger, as much as you can't be frustration. Anger, depression, frustration, they're all the same category of warning signals telling us there's something going on. There's a reason why. And that's so freeing.
Yeah.
It's so freeing to help people understand.
This episode is brought to you by TrueLocal. We're talking about brain health, so why not? TrueLocal partners with local farmers and butchers in your area to source high-quality meat and deliver it to your door. 100% grass-fed and grass-finished beef, pasture-raised chicken, lamb, bison, and more. I recommend their grain-fed beef. I think it tastes better, although their grass-fed beef is good. Wild salmon and their lamb is some of the best I've ever had. They have over 100 different cuts of meat that you probably can't find at your grocery store. Liver, if you're into that. To get started, just go to trulocal.ca for Canadians or trulocalusa.com for Americans to build your own personalized box of meat. Shows up at your door vacuum sealed and individually portioned, which is perfect for meal prep and planning. And get an air fryer so you can just throw it in frozen. It's so easy. It's so easy. I've been using these guys for 3 years. All I eat is meat. I'm picky about my meat. Use code MP to get free steak in your order at trulocal.ca or trulocalusa.com. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Okay, so that's do you want to unpack? We can talk about the mind body. Would you want to unpack anything I've just said?
Yeah. So one thing you said, just a question after that is, if you're stuck in a, let's say, a depressed way of thinking where you get triggered by something and you immediately have a flood of negative thoughts, how are you supposed to start, like, not thinking that way? Because it sounds like a be more positive or,
no, definitely not,
or something.
So glad you asked that question, because this is definitely not positive thinking. I am not a proponent of positive psychology. I think there's some good elements, but it's done a lot of damage, because people think that I can just slap on a positive affirmation. Yeah. I've got to, the ideal is not to have those emotions. What I say is that it's totally okay to be depressed. In fact, it's totally okay to be anxious. It's totally okay to experience any of those. Give yourself permission. Yeah. Yeah. And look at them differently. Shift your perspective. And it's not a matter of, I mustn't think like that. It's the white bear effect. You tell yourself not. So we're not talking about that at all. This is a process of embracing. Embrace as a messenger. What my research showed, my most recent clinical trials, which are in that book, plus there was a super interesting study that came out of Tokyo and Texas, funny enough, just about a year ago, talking about if we in the West, we tend to look at emotions like depression as bad things. But that's not what they are. They're actually incredibly helpful messengers. So if you look at them differently, if you say, okay, I am depressed. I don't like being depressed. I'm feeling awful. I can't get out of bed. This is terrible. I'm anxious. I'm having whatever. It's acknowledge that it's horrible, but don't be scared of it. Don't think this is bad, or this is who I am, or I've got a broken brain, or yeah, I'm stuck. Rather say, okay, this makes me feel horrible, but this is not who I am. It's a helpful messenger. What is it telling me? The minute you do that, you shift 1,400 neurophysiological responses in your brain and your body to work for you, not against you. Now, this is what people aren't being told, Michaela.
Wait.
It's like, sorry, insane.
Before, yeah, okay. 1,400. How did that research come up? How do they know that?
That's not my research. I've done a bit of that research. So collectively over the years, there's been a lot of research. And this goes to the question, the mind-brain-body connection. There's about 150 years of research in the modern scientific method of trying to understand, if we think in a certain way, why does it impact our body and how does it impact our body? And as our techniques have advanced, so we have been able to see that if you are totally not managing your stress, your cortisol levels will rise, your homocysteine levels, all the things we hear about. So there's a direct link that's been established, very established biomarkers for the mind-brain-body connection. I've done work on quite a few of those, and then also on things like telomeres, which are in your DNA and that kind of stuff. And we see a very, I showed my research, and this has also been very, it's pretty established research, that you literally within seconds of you, the way you perceive a situation is going to impact your research, certain biomarkers, your DNA. And if you understand that by shifting how you can shift into two minds at once. We literally can have two mindsets happening at the same time. One is the messy mind that's in that depression or whatever, and the other is the wise mind that stands back and observes your own thinking. We can shift into two. We have the skill. And when we do that, we get different kind of firing in our brain and different interaction between the different parts of the brain, and we move into high levels of intelligence, extremely high levels of intelligence. And so literally we can stand back and observe our own thinking, feeling, and choosing in that state. And so what we want to do is say, okay, I am depressed. So wise mind is literally talking to messy mind, saying, okay, you're depressed. That's fine. That's okay. It's what you're going through. It's how you're showing up. It's all right. We're going to find a reason. There is a reason. And when you talk to yourself like that, we're not denying the situation, which is the worst thing you can
do. You're finding a reason.
Exactly. You're not saying, oh gosh, think positive thoughts. That's the worst thing you can do too, because you're putting a band-aid on a bullet wound. It's not going to work. What you're doing is you are basically acknowledging and embracing. Now, we know from neuroscience, the minute that you acknowledge and embrace this toxic thought that is creating the sense of depression or whatever it is, panic attacks, pain in your body, perspective, I hate life, whatever, the different signals which we can talk about, that as soon as you say, okay, it's fine, then this toxic tree becomes, it moves into the conscious mind. And the little branches that are holding all the data become weakened. And when something's weakened, it's malleable, it's changeable. So alongside that, which is a whole lot of physiological responses, that changes the chemical response in the brain. So we now have an increase of dopamine and an increase of anandamide and an increase of, and so I can go on. That then changes the whole hormone system. That mm-hmm. then changes the endocrine system. That then changes how the heart's functioning, and so I can go on. So if you add it all up, it's around about 1,400 neurophysiological brain-body responses that will occur in a moment that will then shift you into resilience as opposed to breakdown mode. And when you're in resilience mode, you can be sobbing, screaming, crying, broken, lying on the floor. But in that moment, by saying to yourself, this is okay. It's okay. Get it out. It's fine. You're shifting your physiology, which then gives you the strength to then start climbing up and doing the deconstruction, reconstruction process. And that's the power. It's not easy, but that's what you can. That's what you can train yourself to do, because that's what you actually, how your physiology works.
Okay, that is fascinating. So, just a brief background on like what I went through. I was on antidepressants, really high dosage of Cipralex for like 12 years or 13 years. And yeah, me too. And I fixed my diet and my depression went away. And I stopped taking my antidepressants over a period of 2 weeks because I didn't realize...
withdrawal.
I didn't realize that was a thing. And then for about 2.5 years, I had like horrible depression. But I was aware that it had something to do with the medication, because I was like, this is so awful. It can't be real. So one of the things I did during that time was when I had these, they were triggered by like carbier foods, and the withdrawal would get worse, which is something I now know looking back on it. But I'd separate and think, okay, this is happening to me, but it's so awful. It can't be me. So like, it's a reaction that's happening.
Yes.
But, but it's got to go away because it's so crazily bad that I must be able to heal from this, right? And that's kind of what I thought. And eventually I healed and it's gone. So that's kind of crazy to hear, because it's, I didn't realize there was
a thing. You actually did the science. You actually applied instinctively what I've been teaching, what I've just explained to you, and what I've been researching all these years. You are one of the few that's managed to actually do that, because there's not many people. I mean, there's more than a million survivor sites of people that have got off antidepressants and who've kind of gone the journey that you've gone. And I mean, it's, as you and I both said before, like, this shouldn't even be happening in the first place, but it is. You're quite right. The withdrawal, when you take an antidepressant, it basically changes the structures of your brain, and you probably know this, but at the point where these things, the trees that you build, they all connected to each other. And at the point of connection, all the little branches where they connect and where they touch other neurons, it's called a synapse. We get a little doorways, and the doorways increase, and they're abnormal increases. So you're putting too many doors, little doorways in your brain. So that disrupts balance and flow. And so the thing that antidepressant, even the word is scary to use, because it's not correct. It implies that it's like an antibiotic fixing, getting rid of bacteria. It's not fixing anything. All it's doing is numbing. Those doorways create a numbing effect in the brain. But the problem is that it's an abnormal structure. So then the brain starts battling with that. So it has all those side effects, and I'm sure you know about them, but there's just so many bad side effects. Fortunately for neuroplasticity, your brain is healing. So yes, your brain did get damaged, but you've, through your diet, exercise, your mindset, you've not used that first cause of mind to actually drive healing into your brain. And, you know, so yours is a great story that you've come out the other side and you've managed to survive with the withdrawal and that kind of thing. But that's where withdrawal, people need to taper. If people make the decision, you've got to taper. And you've got to do diet and exercise, but you also have to do mind, because you can taper and do diet and exercise, but if you don't get your mind right, if you don't have a way of managing your mind, that'll throw you off, because mind is the biggest force. Mind drives everything. Without mind, there's nothing. The diet doesn't. Mind drives diet. I mean, to the point, Mikhail, I don't know if you're aware of this, but if you're eating and you're eating a super healthy diet, which I know you're very into eating healthy, but if your mind is like all worked up and worried about something in the eating, you lose up to 86% of the nutrition. So, I mean, our mind's driving that digestive system, the assimilation of nutrients, the pancreas, the gallbladder, all of it's been driven by mind. So we don't realize the mind being first cause. We should be teaching mind to our kids in schools as lessons. I did this when I was working in education systems, and when I do still, lessons, there should be lessons at school. We should be teaching our kids from babies. We should never stop learning about how to manage our mind, because mind, messy brain, messy body, messy life. No matter how many books you read or how many podcasts you listen to, it's mind management. Yeah.
Okay. So how do you, like, you must come across people who've been in science for a long time and who are saying this isn't real. How do you convince somebody that mind or anything like mindset actually makes a difference? Because even I didn't believe that, right? I started the diet and then I had that mindset. It wasn't something I worked on. It just popped in, thank goodness. So it wasn't something, it was something I kind of took for granted, and I didn't realize how powerful it could be until I started having some meals where I was horribly stressed, like serious family illness, horribly stressed, and I'd get kind of sick after. And I was like, how? It's the same thing I was eating before. I was like, really? Like, oh no, how much of this is in my head? Which is good, actually, because it means you can control it. But
exactly.
How do you talk to somebody about that and convince them that that actually matters?
Well, let's put it this way. Some of the main science top universities across the globe have for a long time been showing this evidence of mind brain and the impact of our thought life on our physical body. So when someone says it's not real, if a scientist says it's not real, they really aren't up to date with research. That's the first thing. I wouldn't say that to them because they would get, you know, it's an aggressive kind of statement. But just for you and I to know that some of the top scientists are, you know, like you'll get top scientists at Harvard and MIT and, you know, all the Ivy Leagues that won't even talk about psychotropics. I'll say that those are dangerous. That you don't use them. That mind-brain connection is real, you know. That's one side. The other side is the language that's used. So like scientists that say that the brain does everything, look at their research, and I'll give you a synopsis. Where they'll take people, they'll put them into a lab, they'll tell them to do something or think about something, or they'll show them pictures. In other words, they're taking an alive person and they're making them think about something. I say, okay, think of a sad story or look at the sad picture. So they tell them to do something. In other words, they get them thinking and feeling and choosing, and then they measure their brain, or they look at their brain and using fMRI, or they do various different things to test it. So they're saying that the brain produces the depression. Meanwhile, they ask the person to do something that made them have a depression response, and they measure the response in the brain. So it's language. It's how they're looking at it. Does that make sense? They are saying the person in the lab is depressed because their brain is broken. They're looking for the neurobiological correlate. But they didn't just put the person in the lab. They gave the person something to think about first. So first was mind in action, then was response in brain. So they looked at the response in the brain to the person thinking. Even if they didn't tell the person to think of anything, just being in a lab with an fMRI on you, you're going to be anxious. So they're going to pick up anxiety in the anxiety response in the brain. In other words, take a dead person, stick them in the fMRI machine, you won't get response. So that's one of my first things I'll say to them. The other thing is there is such a body of literature. I mentioned earlier on, I've done work in looking at, let's talk about telomeres. It's probably one of the most convincing ways of helping people to process.
Yeah, that would be good.
And telomeres, there's been a lot of research on telomeres in relation to food and diet and exercise and lifestyle, but not a huge amount directly on mind. Mind drives lifestyle. I mean, you know yourself, you had to use your mind. You had to make a decision to change your diet. You used your mind in all your descriptions earlier on. You said, I recognize that I was eating a meal, it made me feel sick. This couldn't be right because this food didn't make me sick before. I recognize I was in a stressful situation. All of that, you were using your mind. You were thinking, feeling, and choosing about your situation. So you used your mind to analyze the mind-brain response. So you looked at your own body and you looked at your mental state. You put two and two together. Ah, boom. It's my mind. So you did that you did research without even knowing you were doing research, and you came to the conclusion and changed. That was all mind driven. Okay, so here's the telomere thing. Telomeres are the if you think of a chromosome, if you think of the DNA strand, everyone can visualize that. And if you pull out a chromosome, it looks like an X. So I'm going to cross my fingers. So anyone listening, watching, they can cross their fingers or whatever. And my fingernails, which are conveniently painted pink at the moment, are, let's pretend they're telomeres. Telomeres are the ends of chromosomes. Telomeres do a lot of stuff. Nothing in the body works in isolation. Everything works together. But we're going to just talk about in terms of one of the main functions at the moment. Telomeres are a proxy for mind health. So how you are actually managing your mind in the moment. So in other words, if you are going through a stressful situation, you eat that meal, in that moment, your mind would have been affecting your telomeres. This is how significant it is. We make about 1 million new cells every second. The quality of those cells then make up your digestive system, your brain, your body. So over time, we are rebuilding every system of our body with our mind driving the cells. So if you think you're making about 1 million cells plus every second, the quality of those cells is determined by the quality of your mind management in the moment. And that hits your telomere. So the telomere is involved in helping to make the cells. The telomeres are reliant on the energy from the mind, which comes through an electromagnetic force and a neurochemical force, which then impacts the telomeres and activates the telomeres to then make the cells.
Sorry, I've got this weird combination of being extremely open and extremely skeptical. One I got from the skepticisms from my dad, the openness is from my mom.
But it's very good.
How do they know that the mind, I believe it, but
no, but how do they know it?
How do they know that the mind is impacting the telomere like length?
Yes. So what I showed in my study, and I can tell you directly from my study, and I actually have got graphs in the book and things. So the telomere, the strength of the telomere, they can fray like a shoelace. Mm-hmm, so if you, and they've done a lot of research showing that people with very poor diets, they've got very weakened telomeres. So they do blood work, you take a blood sample, and then they've got these incredible ways of analyzing the functionality of the telomere. So they look at telomere length, they look at telomere percent. There's different ways that you can look at the telomeres. And then from there, what you've obviously got, we know that if it's a healthy cell, the telomeres is you want an ideal sort of length and ideal sort of strength, so that when they keep staying like a long, strong fingernail, for example. But if your fingernails keep breaking and peeling and chipping and getting worse and worse over time, you may not even have a nail eventually. So they've been able to, through blood work and through studying the telomeres in different circumstances, they can track and see. So people that have had extremely bad diets, exercise, lifestyle, and stress, because when someone has a poor lifestyle, they're not managing their stress either. So they always say stress is one of, but stress is the mind is driving all of it. Mind is driving the choice of what to eat, how to exercise, and also how you are dealing with the day-to-day stuff, plus the big stuff in your life that you haven't dealt with, the traumas, the past issues, etc., etc. So they see, and I saw this in my research. I had, for example, some subjects that came into this, we did a double blind study, by the way. So random control, double blind, all that, all the good stuff, all the gold standard. And some of the subjects came in, well, they all came in a wreck. Everyone's pretty much all of us are mess all the time, but we just got to manage. It's how we're managing our mess, and that's totally okay. It's okay to be a mess. That's really fundamental to my teaching. It's be a mess, just manage it. So, for example, one of the case studies was a more or less 30-year-old and mid-30s millennial, and came in saying, I am depression. And their narrative was just like a mess. Their blood work was a mess, high cortisol, high homocysteine.
Yeah.
All their psychological tools were terrible. And their narrative, the most important thing was their story. What is going on in your life? What's happening? It was like a mess. The telomere length in that particular person was really bad. And telomere length is interesting because it tells you about the cells and cells group to form the body. And so it tells us about the health of your biology, of your actual body. So from a telomere, you can make a judgment on a person's biological age. And so this particular person's biological age was 35 plus years older than their actual chronological age, and it was a sickly older. So if you're in your 30s and you have a body of a sickly 65-year-old, your vulnerability to disease has increased by a factor of up to 60, 70%. If not more. And if it doesn't get treated, you're going to constantly, because it aggregates and accumulates. So the research explains it like, from the research we can say this, that if we don't manage our minds and therefore manage how we're dealing with the triggers and things in our life and the traumas, we are increasing our vulnerability to disease.
Okay.
By these factors that accumulate over time. So it's not, I think a bad thought, I get cancer. That's ridiculous. It's not, I think a good thought, the cancer goes away, which is as ridiculous, which is, you know, the law of attraction, positive thinking. You've got to be so careful of those things because that in itself can bring tremendous guilt to people. It's cycles of 63 days. I've had some patients that went through 2 years of cycles of 63 days because there were so many elements to their trauma that they didn't fix it in one cycle. But every time that you are fixing a cycle, every time you are managing your mind, recognize, as you recognized this food is affecting me in this way, you were shifting the energy that was the energy flow, the electromagnetic flow through your brain, through your body, through your blood, the neurochemistry, the flow, all of that was shifting, which then influenced your telomeres. So your telomeres started being able to heal. So the cells, not in one day, but over time, over the 2 year, 3 year, 4 year period, have been getting stronger and stronger. So your health has been coming back. You know, the same thing will happen with your dad too, and with anyone who is in under any kind of, eventually over time. And not everything, I'm not saying everything's going to get fixed and go away. We sit with collateral damage sometimes. It's so different, Michaela, for everyone. There is no cookie cutter if you do this. All I know is that we saw within 9 weeks three cycles of, is that 63 days, three cycles of 21 days, that the subjects in our control, in our experimental group that got the treatment, that did the mind management, their telomeres lengthened and strengthened. So by the 9-week point, that person that I described in the beginning, that 30-year-old, their chronological and biological age matched. In other words, they were no longer sitting after 9 weeks with a 65-year-old sickly body. They were sitting with a body that was actually closer in age to their chronological age. Their cortisol had dropped. Their homocysteine levels had dropped, which meant the inflammation in their brain and body had significantly dropped, which meant that their heart and brain were no longer at extreme risk for various different things to go wrong. I mean, that's just a couple of things. So, yeah, there's more and more research being done in this area. And the reason when I do research, I look at the psychological and the narrative, and the blood, and the DNA, and the brain. I look at so many elements, which is kind of unusual because research normally looks at just an fMRI or just cortisol. I put them together because you've got to look at people holistically and you've got to see what is the whole pattern that's going on in the person's life. You know, and there you can see that driving force. So that particular person, which really kind of sums this whole thing up, in day one, they were saying, I am depression. Their identity was depression. Their mind and body were a mess. Homocysteine up, inflammation, short telomeres, biological, all the things I've described. By day 21, they were saying, I'm not depression. I can't be depression. It's not my identity. I feel depressed because of radical difference. But I feel, then they also said, and this always fascinated me, they said, I actually feel more depressed and more anxious, but it's different. It's actually helpful. I'm feeling more depressed because now this person had had terrible abuse as a child and had never faced it. It had been suppressed. And this treatment, the entering into the protocol, into the clinical study, had given her, the subject, a way of unpacking. And so the sadness and depression came from, oh my gosh, that happened to me. When you start seeing stuff that happened to you as a child, I mean, it's traumatic. So there was another level of trauma. But by day 63, this person was saying, okay, I accept that this happened to me. I can't change that it happened, but I can change how I manage it. It's not going to control me the rest of my life. I'm going to get back their life. And that's a big summary of the whole thing. Obviously the detail I don't share, but the big picture, I do, that particular subject is in this book as a case study, which gives people so much hope. And that's why I do this research, because I want people to see that yes, every thought you think is having an impact. You're always thinking, and you can either stay messy, which is just going to make you really frustrated, or you can own your mess and change it. Because if you, through mess, we can repair and we can grow. It's so okay to be messy as long as we're managing it. So that's kind of the philosophy.
That's insane. So through mind management, you measured people's telomeres length and you could increase it. That is insane.
It is insane.
And was anything else changed? Like, did you also change diet? Did you incorporate exercise?
No, nothing.
Or it was just,
yes. Okay.
That is
one variable. So, because there's so much work done on exercise. And I do, I mean, I talk about that all the time. I write books about it. It's so important. But I can put you on a great diet. If I don't help you get your mind right, you're not going to get the same benefit. So we didn't touch that in the study. We're doing more studies and we'll bring that. But I wanted to get the mind managed. I wanted to show people, listen, it's your mind. Mind is first cause. So if we can get a hand on that and give ourselves permission to be sad and depressed and angry and frustrated and get it out. If it doesn't go out, it goes in. If we can do that and then recognize, okay, I've got to go beyond just awareness. I've got to get it out. I've got to be aware. I've got to go beyond. What we're doing currently in this current day and age, and I'm just talking very generally, but in the wellness industry, and you're very well versed in this area, is that, and it's not wrong, that people are, okay, let's meditate, let's breathe. Yes, let's do that. But that only prepares your brain. So you'll see in the systems that I've developed, you do brain preparation and then you go beyond. So you do brain preparation, is your breathing, your meditation, your havening, all those beautiful things that are vital to get neurochemistry and stuff under control. But they're not enough. The research shows if I just create awareness in you, it's going to make you worse. And I showed that in my control group, because we had a control group. Yeah, we had a control group, and I've got that study in here too, of the one of the case studies of one of the subjects who, same sort of age as the one I just described, but they didn't get the treatment, but they got all the testing. So they were super aware of all their issues because they kept getting asked all these questions and having contact with people. But they got worse and worse and worse and worse, and eventually got what we call a red brain, which was such high levels of anxiety that they were in a dangerous position. Obviously, we gave them the treatment. Ethically, we did. With all of the subjects in the control group, they all got the treatment because it was randomized. And there was a change almost immediately. I mean, it was phenomenal. So awareness alone, and this is what we're seeing in the literature too, that people that if you just meditate, you bring stuff up, but what are you going to do with it? You have to deconstruct it. So people meditate, stuff comes up, and then they shove it down. You can't breathe it away. You can't meditate it away. You meditate and breathe to get resilience in your brain and your body and to help get your alpha levels going so you can connect the unconscious and conscious. But now you've got to do work. This ugly thing has to be deconstructed. You have to find the root and you have to change it and make it work for you and not against you.
Okay, so how do you do that?
I knew that question was coming. Good question. Okay, so I wanted to know how to do this 38 years ago because I was told as a therapist, just teach your patients to compensate. Teach them techniques. I thought, techniques are not going to work. They're going to work, yes, in the right place. So CBT, ACT, all these, you know, there's a million techniques out there that mm-hmm. therapists have and that you can see and you can Google and find them and find books. But techniques alone don't solve the problem. So I wanted to get to the basics. Okay, how does a thought form? How do these thoughts form? What are memories? What am I doing to grow this? And then if I grow it, how do I get rid of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's what I wanted to know.
Fair.
I wanted to know, yeah. So I wanted to also know, how do I find them? How do I know when I've got these?
Yeah.
What do they look like? What are the signs that I've got this? And how do I deal with them? Because in anyone, I mean, you and I could just brainstorm now, and I tell you, I'll come up with at least 10 things I need to work on that are upsetting me at the moment. And definitely, if I don't manage, will impair my functioning. And I'm sure you could. So, and that's normal.
At least,
that's good.
Yep.
Yeah, that's good. That's really being human. That's great. But what we need to do is say, okay, well, these are the things happening. Let's be thought detectives and let's say, okay, which is the top one? That's number one. That's my priority. This thing's really affecting. I'll kind of deal with those later. So you select your top priority and then you start analyzing. So you start with, so this is the top, choose, the, make a list. Choose the top one. I'm just giving you a quick rundown. It's in detail in here. And I also have an app. I don't know if you're aware. I have an app.
We should talk about the app too.
The NeuroCycle app, which walks you through. It's like me giving you therapy, literally. Okay, so first of all, you make the decision to look at your patterns, choose the top one. Then what you do is you start, second thing is you start then saying, okay, what? Let me break my pattern down. First of all, what are my emotions? What are my behaviors? What are my body symptoms? And what is my perspective? The easiest way to do this is many ways, but one of the ways I would do with my patients is I would say, get two chairs and you sit in one and you're also in the other one. In the one that you physically are, that's the messy mind. Or whatever, and then the other one is the wise mind. What is the wise mind? The wise mind is what we see in neurobiology, is that you have no wiring in your brain and body for anything toxic. So we don't have depression in here wired, waiting to jump out. We don't have anger. We don't have anything. We don't have, none of that's in the brain. The brain is
People
wired.
Still believe that though,
I know.
Right? They have a deficiency, a serotonin deficiency or something.
Or some kind of brain disease, because that's the language that's used.
Yeah.
That's what people are told. Take the drugs. You've got a brain disease. It'll fix your drug. Don't get people stigmatize you. Meanwhile, the research has shown that stigmatized people more. And I don't know if you're aware of this research, and I put it in my book too. But that approach has increased people's death, shortened people's lifespan. So between 1996 and 2014, a massive series of studies was done where they found that for decades we've been living longer, obviously because of advances in medicine and technology, but that reversed, started reversing in 96. By 2014, it was an established reversal. It's called categorized as deaths of despair. So essentially, people are dying 8 to 25 years younger than they should now in this modern age. It's 2 years added to this with the pandemic. From preventable lifestyle issues. So people are dying younger. And Gen Z is the most medicated generation ever in history. And they are the most
so
risk
sad.
Of dying 8 to 25 years younger, which is terrible. And it's our fault as adults, as leaders, as whatever, because our generation has adopted the last 40 years has totally messed this up. We're sitting not with a pandemic in mental health. We're sitting with a pandemic result of mismanagement of mental health. We've had total mismanagement, and your story, your dad's story, and the millions of stories that I read, and I get thousands of emails a week of people that have had the same story. And that's why I'm so passionate about getting this out there. So essentially, what the first thing I want people to do is to say, please give yourself permission. It's okay. Whatever you've experienced and whatever you're experiencing, you at your core are wired for love. You're amazing. And that's not just me being motivational. I'm not a motivational speaker. I'm a realist. I'm a scientist. Your neurobiology is phenomenal. You have all these systems in place to fight. Like if you have the COVID virus, your immune system goes crazy and tries to fight it. If you have a toxic trauma in your life, as I mentioned earlier, your immune system will do the same thing. It will also send out T lymphocytes and B lymphocytes and macrophages to go eat this thing, to go get rid of it. But if the source keeps it there, which is your mind is the source, it keeps it there, then no amount of immune help is going to, it's just going to become extra inflamed and you're going to get an autoimmune response and a bodily response there. So what we want to do is we want to listen to the signals of the immune system, which will affect how our body's functioning. And we want to listen to the signals of our, so the somatic sensations in our body. We want to listen to the signals of our emotions and the signals of our behaviors. So having said all of that, start with the core premise that you're amazing, that you're brilliant, that you're wired for love, and however you're showing up is because of adverse circumstances that have aggregated and accumulated, and you've slid down the scale. I always use the scale 0 to 10 and 0 to minus 10. And the average is minus 4 to plus 4, and in any one day we have good and bad stuff happening. But generally we can kind of manage it, and that's all cool. It's totally fine. It's when it aggregates and we start sitting around the minus 4 area, and then it shifts down minus 5, minus 6, so and so on, into extreme states. And that's when people get completely stuck, and that's when people get labeled with all these labels. Now, the research shows that as soon as you get a label, you've just chopped off up to another. That's the 25-year end. Without a label, you're in the 8-year end of dying earlier. With a label, a mental health label, you've just pushed yourself into the potential 25-year younger death. So you die maybe at 65 instead of 85 or something like that. And it's preventable. So I'm so hot on not telling people this so people can get out of that. Because you can get out of that. You don't have to be stuck in that. It's not a death sentence. So we get aware, we move on. Okay, so it's give yourself permission. So it's basically look at the pattern with those four areas, which is the emotions, behaviors. What am I feeling? Depression. What are my behaviors? I'm more withdrawn than normal, crying more than normal. Nothing wrong with crying, but if your crying pattern has changed, if anything's changed, that's what you're looking at. Body, what's going on in your body? There's so much about body and how trauma is stored in the body. It is stored in the body. You've got to look at your body. You listening to me now, you're not only building a healthy thought in your brain of the stuff, but you also, as soon as it's in your brain sends a message to every cell of your body. You've got 37 to 100 trillion, and you've changed your DNA. So your genes are building this memories in your brain as a tree. And it's in your body, in your genes, in every single cell of your body, your memories form. It's like mind-blowing to think of. So it's in your body. That's why people experience trauma in their body, and EMDR and those kind of things pull it out of the body, into the brain, into the mind. There's the third place that memories or thoughts are stored within memories is in the mind. Now think of this podcast. If you look at the little bars at the bottom, you'll see little bars running if you're watching a podcast. You know the little bars I'm talking about? That's a visual for mind. Mind is a gravitational field around you and through you. It's an electromagnetic field. So memory is also stored all around you. You've got your memories in these fields and in your brain as a tree and in your body. So it's in three places. So that's why it's such a holistic experience when we have a trauma and we recall it and you go through a traumatic event and you're building all of that into you. So you're experiencing it with all of you. So we have to address all of you. So you have to then say, okay, what is going on? Let me be the thought detective. Let me look at my body. Increased GI issues, increased maybe heart palpitations, whatever. What are the body signs? What are the, as I said, emotions? What are the behavior changes? And then perspective, that's massive. How am I looking at life? Am I seeing it life sucks? Or am I thinking this always happens to me? But your overarching perspective that is activated when you think of this particular pattern is very important because it'll lead you to your trauma response, your coping mechanism, the type of trauma. Are you in flight, fright, freeze, fawning? Yeah. It leads to those kind of things. So you look at those. And I walk you through this whole process in depth in my app called Neurocycle and in the book. Then you literally say, okay, I've got the pattern. I've started seeing these different areas. Now I'm going to start unpacking them. But before you do that, you now just need to give yourself a little bit of brain boosting resilience. And that's where you can meditate, you can breathe, you can, I know your dad did Wim Hof, I've interviewed him too, and he didn't like that. And a lot of people battle when you breathe and get into meditative states. If you've got trauma, it can make you freak out. So you can do things with your eyes opening, you can do havening and tapping. So I recommend my highly traumatized patients, I used to just do, let's just do some tapping, because that you keep your eyes open, don't, you know, anything just to lower the neurochemistry.
What does that do?
It sends a, when you tap like that or give yourself a hug, that creates a, it sends a very strong sense of, it's basically like an alpha wave through your brain and your body up into your amygdala, And then your amygdala is a library, and like libraries have got books with information. There's books with good information about I can do this, and there's books with this is terrible, life sucks.
Yeah.
And if our amygdala is stimulated incorrectly, the life sucks books hit you on the head. But if you tap or breathe or any one of those brain preparation, you actually close that part of the library and you open the other part that says, oh, maybe I can do this. So that's a simple explanation. It does a bunch of other stuff too, but it sends a very calming wave to the amygdala, which enables us to get that neurochemistry and that you don't want the high beta flowing through the amygdala, and it will when we're in a panic state. So you want to just get the beta down. So what I do is, in brain preparation, is you choose whatever technique. And in the app, I have a 3-minute little technique every day, and you can try that or try your own. And we're building a whole lot more into the app, so you can just choose whatever you want to do. Then you start with the actual neurocycle. So the neurocycle was developed. I developed it 38 years ago with my TBI patients and my Alzheimer's, dementia, all those patients, learning disability. I've developed a theory, so this is very scientific. And then I wanted a practical application. Patients aren't interested in theories. They're interested in what do I do? And so I wanted to find the actual steps. So all the stuff I'm talking about, all these thoughts, brain, how do thoughts form, all of it, I wanted to work out, if I do this, what's happening in the brain? If I do this, what's happening in the brain? So in the book, I've got a chart where I explain the 5 steps in detail with what's happening in the mind, brain, and body. But you've got to set the neurocycle up, which I've just explained. Acceptance, look at the pattern, do the breathing or tapping or whatever, and then you start the neurocycle. Before I explain the 5 steps, you do it for a limited amount of time. If you're working on a hectic trauma or a really a thing that is hard for you in your life, you spend 15 to 45 minutes max.
Yeah. Okay.
So important.
Yeah.
That's so important. So you can do this in as quick as 7 minutes because it's 5 steps. The brain preparation, I always recommend like three minutes or so. So if you can block off 15 to 45 minutes once a day for 63 days, I know it sounds a lot, but here's my argument. Your mind's a mess anyway. So if all you're doing is using your mind, I'm not saying you, I'm saying all of us. If you've got a trauma, your mind's working anyway, so you may as well work it in the direction you want. This is directed neuroplasticity.
Yeah.
So it's an organized technique that you do for 15 to 45 minutes for 21 days. The second phase of 42 days, the other 2 cycles of 21, you only take 5 minutes. So it's not a lot to do. And when you get into this, it's so life-saving. That pattern that's dominating your functioning at the moment is suddenly not going to be dominating your functioning because you're allocating a 15 to 45 minute block once a day to deal with it. So the rest of the day, you can actually be set free from that because you're not going to think of it the rest of the day. You're going to work on it tomorrow morning or whenever you choose your time. And then that process, one of the biggest problems with therapy and intervention and counseling and coaching is what we call carryover. Carryover is you're great in therapy with your therapist, but like when you leave therapy, it's kind of hard to always apply that. So carryover is always a big challenge. And so I wanted to bring that in. I did a lot of research in how do you train someone to do something, help them in therapy or help them on their own, but they carry that over into the day. So the neurocycle is a way of thinking that you can use in this very almost self-therapy sense. You can use in therapy. I have a lot of therapists that use it. We have a coaching course and everything. And you can use on your own, because if you're not with your therapist every day, you're with your therapist maybe once or twice a week, or counselor, or coach. You live with yourself. You're waking up with yourself at night and your mind's going crazy. You need mind management 24/7. So this neurocycle provides you with a way of doing therapy, a way of doing your daily therapy with yourself, the serious stuff, and then it's also a way of catching yourself when you have chaos during the day. And you mentioned that earlier on, what happens if all these thoughts are like this? What do I do? You neurocycle. So it's a way of catching stuff and then unpacking it, getting it in order and getting control. And you're using your wise mind, your neurobiology that's wired for survival. Your survival mind kicks in as soon as you say, okay, this is okay. I'm aware of this. I'm going to gather. And as soon as you do the thing I've just said, your wise mind takes over. Your neurobiology changes. Those 1400 neurophysiological responses kick in and you start being able to get control. You get agency. And as the more you do this, the more you get empowered. So over time, I showed in a 9-week period, my patients, my subjects in my clinical trial, and this has happened for years because I've been working on this for years, there was an 81% ability to, increased 81, agency increased by 81%, which meant that my mind's chaos, I can't do this, I've got 81% more power to get this under control versus zero power or 10% power, which is, my day's a mess and it just gets worse. Does that make sense?
That's insane. That is so cool. Like, that is so cool. Yeah, I've been, I just finished, I've been writing a book, and I've been writing a book for since I was like in grade one, because that was part of the way I handled bad things that were happening, is I wrote them down. So I've turned it into a book. I finally finished the book. But
congrats.
It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible to write, because everything I was writing was just, I had to relive it. It made me cry, but then I felt better after. But I did
You got it up. You deconstructed it.
Yeah. And I do exercise first. So I was able to write. And then I'd work, and I'd only work for up to 45 minutes.
Good.
Because I couldn't tolerate more. I noticed if I did like 2 hours, I was just wiped for 3 or 4 days. And I'd like cry a bunch the whole time. It got easier, but at the beginning it was just like sobbing.
So
and
hard.
Then I'd finish it. It's so hard. But yeah, it's so interesting to learn some of the actual science behind things are doing. Because I was just I don't know why this is making me feel better, but it's working.
There you go. You describe what that subject described, where they said they got worse. They were more depressed and sad, but it was different because they were seeing the pain. So you were processing through the pain. It's a treatment effect. We would always see. I always warn my patients: you get worse before you get better. You know, that's just inevitable. But people aren't always prepared for that, because people think people can go into,
you feel it. It's bad.
Yeah, people can go from extreme anxiety, non-functional, functional, and then into deep depression as they start seeing. And then people think you've gone backwards. You haven't gone backwards. That's progress. Because that deep depression is evidence of you just trying to manage what you found. So your crying, your tears, it was your just sadness and getting it out, and it's been there for so many years and processing and getting it out. So that's so, and we've got to, that's what we've got to do. We've got to level the playing field. So you actually went through all these processes. I've just taken what we are. You see, you prove Wired for Love. You prove that we have an optimism bias. You prove that mind is first cause. Everything you've gone through, all I've done is the science of behind what you've actually experienced. So this is, I'm talking about the science of a basic human philosophy, how we function, and basically putting it into systems. So the neurocycle you pretty much did, as you sat down and wrote, you first gathered awareness of your thoughts for the day. And you would have got there with, you know, the pattern, all those things. You may not have distinctly done the behavior, emotion in that order, but you would have
actually here's where it gets weirder. Okay, so that was finishing my book. My book was like, that was more recent. That's when I'm much healthier. It was a lot easier. It was still emotional, but it was easier. When I was actually in the healing period, when I'd stopped taking the medications and I was in SSRI withdrawal, I spent time each day monitoring how I was, like studying myself, because it was the only way I stayed sane. I was like, what are my digestive symptoms? What's my mood? I had a scale from 0 to 10, zero being the worst. Yeah, that's so weird. But mine was 0 to 10, so not negative 10 to plus 10. And I put down like every symptom I could think of 3 times a day for like 2.5 years, so that I could monitor the patterns.
Wow. That's phenomenal. You did a whole research study there. You should put that in your book too. I mean, that's really insanely brilliant, because that is that's mind management. You've just demonstrated the principles of mind management, because the neurocycles literally gather awareness, then reflect on them, which is ask, answer, discuss, write them down. I've developed a technique called metacogging, which is something you'd love when you learn how to do it. It's in the book and the app, and it's a way of writing that forces the two sides of the brain to work together, and it digs deep into get your intuitive skills like boosted. So you can tap into your non-conscious. So cool. Like, I used to do this with a lot with my patients that were battling with, you know, schizophrenic symptoms and like multiple personalities and like severe trauma where they were non-functional. I would actually teach them to learn using the neurocycle. So they would learn educational stuff because that builds resilience. And then I'd work on the heavy stuff, and because it got the brain set up for being able to and deal with the shock of trauma and the emotions and that kind of thing. And I would using the metacog within the neurocycle, because it's step 3 of the neurocycle, I would help them. They would basically be writing all over this paper, and they would be, I'd say, okay, tell me how you're feeling or something, or what's going on, or what's this. And they would have 5 different versions, but they'd never seen that. Then they suddenly saw it in this format, and they said, 5 different personalities, and each one came from a level of trauma going back to the inner child and all that stuff. So I mean, I'm saying this neurocycle that I'm talking about, this is like, it's come from heavy, heavy research and application. And I've simplified it so much that anyone, a child can do this, but it's doing the most phenomenal stuff in your brain. And then the fourth step is also where you, that writing step, that third step is kind of chaos. It's just like you're kind of dragging all this stuff out of the non-conscious and dumping it. And then recheck is where you go and like sort it out. And what are the patterns and triggers and antidotes? And you reconceptualize. And reconceptualizing is accepting that, okay, this happened, but it doesn't, I can change this. I can see it differently. So instead of, for example, oh, everyone always leaves me, I can't keep a relationship going. It's not, no, everyone's always leaving you. Reconceptualize that is that you're always trying to make it work. So you're always trying to stay because you're trying to make it work. That's a reconceptualization. It's another perspective. And it's only when we start reconceptualizing, which takes the first few steps to get to that point, that you can start shifting and moving forward. And then the fifth step is a little action that you do to keep you in a safe space during the day. That's got various components to it. So, I mean, that's just a very brief overview, and it's like super clear in the book and in the app. I literally walk you through it. And the app, we're growing all the time. And we're building in a neurocycle lab where people can bring their problems and we can talk through and work through how to do it. So, yeah, lots of things happening.
That is so cool. I've been working on an app with my dad for resilience, where it helps you identify factors in your life that you're upset with, and then identify what exactly you're upset with. And then this is simplified, but basically yeah. make to-do lists in order to slowly chip away at the problems in your life.
Wonderful.
Hopefully that'll help people. Okay, our time is up. I cannot recommend this enough. That was absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
A bit shocked. That's so cool. I didn't realize that there was actual research out on this stuff, because it's so complicated, like suggesting yes. that the mind is separate from the brain. Even that's not how I was brought up at all.
No,
that's not what I learned. So that's incredible. And I hopefully that gives people a lot of hope. So thank you very much. If people aren't following you, where can they find you online?
Dr. Caroline Leaf, my social media handle, so they can find me. And then from, as you know, from Instagram, you can find everything, my webpage. I have a podcast called Cleaning Up the Mental Mess. I need to have you on. We need to talk through what you did.
So mental mess, yes.
Yeah. No, we need mine too. No, but just the way you describe it, it'll be very helpful for people. But yeah, people can find out that. I've got tons of information there. To Caroline Lee's probably the best place to go first, because from there, as I said, you get to everything.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for coming on.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it. Thank you. It was great questions.